Chapter 13. The ship dropped quietly to land on the edge of the wide clearing, 100 yards or so from the village. It arrived suddenly and unexpectedly, but with a minimum of fuss. One moment it was a perfectly ordinary late afternoon in the early autumn. The leaves were just beginning to turn red and gold. The river was beginning to swell again with the rains from the mountains in the north. The plumage of the picker birds was beginning to thicken in anticipation of the coming winter frosts. Any day now the perfectly normal beasts would start their thunderous nifty one, a small, sleek, rundy four-berth runabout with just about every optional extra in the brochure, except advanced vectoid stabilisys, which only wimps went for. You can't get a good, tight, sharp curve around a trilateral time axis with advanced vectoid stabilisys. All right, it's a bit safer, but it makes the handling go all soggy. The villagers didn't know all that, of course. Most of them here on the remote planet of Lamuella had never even seen a spaceship, certainly not one that was all in one piece, and as it shone warmly in the evening light, it was just the most extraordinary thing they'd come across since the day turned to look at the strange object in amazement. Or not quite everybody. The picker birds tended to be amazed by completely different things. A perfectly ordinary leaf lying unexpectedly on a stone would cause them to skitter off in paroxysms of confusion. Sunrise always took them completely by surprise every morning. But the arrival of an alien craft from another world simply failed to engage any part of their attention. They continued to car and rit and huck as they pecked for seeds on the ground. The river continued its quiet, spacious burbling. Also, the noise of loud and tuneless singing from the last hut on the left continued unabated. Suddenly, with a slight click and a hum, a door folded itself outwards and downwards from the spaceship. Then, for a minute or two, nothing further seemed to happen, other than the loud singing from the last hut on the left, and the thing just sat there. Some of the villagers, particularly the boys, began to edge forward a little bit to have a closer look. Old Thrashbarg tried to shoo them back. This was exactly the sort of thing that old Thrashbarg didn't like to have happening. He hadn't foretold it, not even slightly, and even though he'd be able to wrestle the whole thing into his continuing story somehow or other, it really was all getting a bit much to deal with. He strode forward, pushed the boys back, and raised his arms and his ancient knobbly staff into the air. The long, warm light of the evening sun caught him nicely. He prepared to welcome whatever gods these were, as if he had been expecting them all along. Still, nothing happened. Gradually it became clear that there was some kind of argument going on inside the craft. Time went by, and old Thrashbarg's arms were beginning to ache. Suddenly, the ramp folded itself back up again. That made it easy for Thrashbarg. They were demons, and he had repulsed them. The reason he hadn't yet... Two figures at last emerged on it, still arguing with each other and ignoring everybody, even Thrashbarg, whom they wouldn't even have noticed from where they were standing. Old Thrashbarg chewed angrily on his beard. To continue to stand there with his arms upraised? To kneel with his head bowed forward and his staff held out pointing at them? To fall backwards as if overcome in some titanic inner struggle? Perhaps just to go off to the woods and live in a tree for a year without speaking to anyone. He opted just to drop his arms smartly as if he had done what he had meant to do. They were really hurting, so he didn't have much choice. He made a small secret sign he had just invented towards the ramp, which had closed, and then made 3½ steps backwards so he could get a good look at whoever these people were, and then decide what to do next. The taller one was a very good-looking woman, wearing soft and crumply clothes. Old Thrashbarg didn't know this, but they were made of Rimplon, a new synthetic fabric, which was terrific for space travel because it looked its absolute best when it was all creased and sweaty. The shorter one was a girl. She was awkward and sullen-looking, and was wearing clothes which looked their absolute worst when they were all creased and sweaty. And what was more, she almost certainly knew it. All eyes watched them, except for the picker birds, which had their own things to watch. The woman stood and looked chanting. He threw back his head and began to wail, but was instantly interrupted by a fresh outbreak of song from the hut of the sandwich maker, the last one on the left. The woman looked round sharply, and gradually a smile came over her face. Without so much as a glance at old Thrashbarg, she started to walk towards the hut. There is an art to the business of making sandwiches, which it is given to few ever to find the time to explore in depth. It is a simple task, but the opportunities for satisfaction are many and profound, choosing the right bread, for instance. The sandwich maker had spent many months in daily consultation and experiment with Grupp the baker, and eventually they had, between them, created a loaf of exactly the consistency that was dense enough to slice thinly and neatly, while still being light, moist, and having the best of that fine nutty flavour which best enhanced the savour of roast, perfectly normal beast flesh. There was also the geometry of the slice to be refined, the precise relationships between the width and height of the slice, and also its thickness, which would give the proper sense of bulk and weight to the finished sandwich. Here again, lightness was a virtue, but so too were firmness, generosity, and that promise of succulence and savour that is the hallmark of a truly intense sandwich experience. The proper tools, of course, were crucial, and many were the days that the sandwich maker, when not engaged with the baker at his oven, would spend with Strinder the toolmaker, weighing and balancing knives, taking them to the forge and back again. Suppleness, strength, keenness of edge, length and balance were all enthusiastically debated, theories put forward, tested, refined, and many was the evening when the sandwich maker and the toolmaker could be seen silhouetted against the light of the setting sun and the toolmaker. It was an exalted position, and that apprentice, Drimple, almost argued why Almighty Bob would send his only begotten sandwich maker in a burning fiery chariot, rather than perhaps in one that might have landed quietly without destroying half the forest, filling it with ghosts, and also injuring the sandwich maker quite badly. Old Thrashbarg said that it was the ineffable will of Bob, and when they asked him what ineffable meant, he said, look it up. This was a problem, because old Thrashbarg had the only dictionary, and he wouldn't let them borrow it. They asked him why not, and he said that it was not for them to know the will of Almighty Bob. And when they asked him why not again, he said, because he said so. Anyway, somebody sneaked into old Thrashbarg's hut one day while he was out having their right hand was doing, so to speak. Quite often, their right hand had a pretty hazy notion as well. Did he dare just post the thing to himself? Did he dare just put it in the system and let the Vogons work out how to get the thing to him, while at the same time they were busy, as they presumably would be, tearing the building apart to find out where he'd hidden it? Yes. Feverishly he packed it. He wrapped it. He labelled it. With a moment's pause to wonder if he really was doing the right thing, he committed the package to the building's internal mail chute. "Colin," he said, turning to the little hovering ball, "I'm going to abandon you to your fate."
"I'm so happy," said Colin.
"Make the most of it," said Ford, "because what I want you to do is nursemaid that package out of the building. They'll probably incinerate you when they find you, and I won't be here to help. It'll be very, very nasty for you, and that's just too bad. Got it?"
"I gurgle with pleasure," said Colin.
"Go," said Ford. Colin obediently dived down the mail chute in pursuit of his charge. Now Ford had only himself to worry about, but that was still quite a substantial worry. There were noises of heavy running footsteps outside the door, which he had taken the precaution of locking and shifting a large filing cabinet in front of. He was worried that everything had gone so smoothly. Everything had fitted terribly well. He'd hurtled through the day with reckless abandon and ordinary low again. Chapter 15. The first month, getting to know each other, was a little difficult. The second month, trying to come to terms with what they'd got to know about each other in the first month, was much easier. The third month, when the box arrived, was very tricky indeed. At the beginning, it was a problem even trying to explain what a month was. This had been a pleasantly simple matter for Arthur, here on Lamuella. The days were just a little over 25 hours long, which basically meant an extra hour in bed every single day, and of course having regularly to reset his watch, which Arthur rather enjoyed doing. He also felt at home with the number of suns and moons which Lamuella had, one of each, as opposed to some of the planets he'd fetched up on from time to time, which had had ridiculous numbers of them. The planet orbited its single sun every 300 days, which was a good number because it meant the year didn't drag by. The moon orbited Lamuella just over 9 times a year, which meant that a month was a little over 30 days, which was absolutely perfect because it gave you a little more time to get things done in. It was not merely reassuringly like Earth, it was actually rather an improvement. Random, on the other hand, thought she was trapped in a recurring nightmare. She would have crying fits and think the moon was out to get her. Every night it was there, and then, when it went, the sun came out and followed her, over and over again. Trillian had warned Arthur that Random might have some difficulty in adjusting to a more regular lifestyle than she had been used to up till now, but Arthur hadn't been ready for actual howling at the moon. He hadn't been ready for any of this, of course. His daughter? His daughter?
But she wasn't quite as random as her name suggests, because, of course, you were the only Homo sapiens donor. I must say, though, it seems you were quite a frequent flyer. Arthur had stared wide-eyed at the unhappy-looking girl who was slouching awkwardly in the doorframe looking at him.
But when? How long?
You mean what age is she? Said Trillian.
Yes.
The wrong one.
What do you mean?
I mean, said Trillian, that I haven't any idea.
What?
Well, in my timeline, I think it's about 10 years since I had her, but she's obviously quite a lot older than that. I spend my life going backwards and forwards in time, you see, with the job. I used to take her with me when I could, but it just wasn't always possible. Then I used to put her into daycare time zones, but you just can't get reliable time tracking now. You leave them there in the morning and you've simply no idea how old they'll be in the evening. You complain till you're blue in the face, but it doesn't get you anywhere. I left her at one of the places for a few hours once, and when I came back, she'd passed puberty. I've done all I can, Arthur. It's over to you. I've got a war to cover.
The 10 seconds that passed after Trillian left were about the longest of Arthur Dent's life. Time, we know, is relative. You can travel light years through the stars and back, and if you do it at the speed of light, then when you return, you may have aged mere seconds, while your twin brother or sister will have aged 20, 30, 40, or however many years it is, depending on how far you travelled. This will come to you as a profound personal shock, particularly if you didn't know you had a twin brother or sister. The seconds that you have been absent for will not have been sufficient time to prepare you, since he had not had the slightest inkling of a suspicion when he'd woken that morning. Deep emotional family ties cannot be constructed in 10 seconds, however far and fast you travel away from them. And Arthur could only feel hopeless, bewildered, and numb as he looked at the girl standing in his doorway, staring at his floor. He supposed there was no point in pretending not to be hopeless. He walked over and he hugged her.
"I don't love you," he said. "I'm sorry, I don't even know you yet. But give me a few minutes."
An extract from Practical Parenting in a Fractally Demented Universe. We live in strange times. We also live in strange places, each in a universe of our own. The people with whom we populate our universes are the shadows of whole other universes intersecting with our own. Being able to glance out into this bewildering complexity of infinite recursion and say things like, "Oh, hi, Ed. Nice tan. How's Carol?" involves a great deal of filtering skill for which all conscious entities have eventually to develop a capacity in order to protect themselves from the contemplation of the chaos through which they seethe and tumble. So, give your kid a break, okay?
"What's this?"
Arthur had almost given up. That is to say, he was not going to give up. He was absolutely not going to give up. Not now, not ever. But if he had been the sort of person who was going to give up, this was probably the time he would have done it. Not content with being surly, bad-tempered, wanting to go and play in the Paleozoic era, not seeing why they had to have the gravity on the whole time, and shouting at the sun to stop following her, Random had also used his carving knife to dig up stones to throw at the picker birds for looking at her like that. Arthur didn't even know if Lamuella had a Paleozoic era. The rest of them were watching to explain to her about his. It was a tricky business. The common ground between them, apart from the fact that they had almost identical genes, was about the size of a pebble. Or rather, it was about the size of Trillian, and of her they had slightly differing views.
"What's this?"
He suddenly realized she had been talking to him and he hadn't noticed, or rather, he had not recognized her voice. Instead of the usual tone of voice in which she spoke to him, which was bitter and truculent, she was just asking him a simple question. He looked round in surprise. She was sitting there on a stool in the corner of the hut, in that rather hunched way she had, knees together, feet splayed out, with her dark hair hanging down over her face, as she looked at something she had cradled in her hands. Arthur went over to her, a little nervously. Her mood swings were very unpredictable, but so far they'd all been between different types of bad ones. Outbreaks of bitter recrimination would give way without warning to abject self-pity, and then long bouts of sullen despair, which were punctuated with sudden acts of mindless violence against inanimate objects, and demands to go to electric clubs. Not only were there no electric clubs on Lamuella, there were no clubs at all, and in fact no electricity. There was a forge and a bakery, a few carts and a well, but the patient had to start with the villagers, and not have them rushing off to peer at Random's wrist all the time.
At the moment, she was not peering at her wrist. Her wrist was turned off. Arthur squatted down quietly beside her to see what she was looking at. It was his watch. He had taken it off when he had gone to shower under the local waterfall, and Random had found it and was trying to work it out. "It's just a watch," he said. "It's to tell the time." "I know that," she said, "but you keep on fiddling with it, and it still doesn't tell the right time, or even anything like it." She brought up the display on her wrist panel, which automatically produced a readout of local time. Her wrist panel had quietly got on with the business of measuring the local gravity and orbital momentum, and had noticed where the sun was and tracked its movement in the sky all within the first few minutes of Random's arrival. It had then quickly picked up clues from its environment as to what the local unit conventions were, and in normal time she was not only always in the wrong place, but she was also almost always there at the wrong time. She didn't notice that she felt this, because it was the only way she ever felt, just as it never seemed odd to her that nearly everywhere she went she needed to wear either weights or anti-gravity suits, and usually special apparatus for breathing as well. The only places you could ever feel right were the worlds you designed for yourself to inhabit, virtual realities in the electric clubs. It had never occurred to her that the real universe was something you could actually fit into. And that included this Lamuella place her mother had dumped her in. And it also included this person who had bestowed on her this precious and magical gift of life in return for a seat upgrade. It was just as well he turned out to be rather kind and friendly, or there would have been trouble, really. She'd got a specially sharpened stone in her pocket she could cause a lot of trouble with. It can be very dangerous to see things from somebody else's yet, and that she would shy away from him. But something was working, something was easing inside her. The watch meant something to her that nothing in her life so far had managed to do. Arthur was not sure that he had really understood what it was yet, but he was profoundly pleased and relieved that something had reached her. "Explain to me again," said Random. "There's nothing really to it," said Arthur. "Clockwork was something that developed over hundreds of years." "Earth years," said Random. "Yes. It became finer and finer and more intricate. It was highly skilled and delicate work. It had to be made very small and had to carry on working accurately however much you waved it around or dropped it." "But only on one planet," said Random. "Well, that was where it was made, you see," said Arthur. "It was never expected to go anywhere else and deal with different suns and moons and magnetic fields and things. I mean, the thing still goes perfectly well, but it doesn't really mean much this far from Switzerland."
"From where?"
"Switzerland, that's where these things were made. Small, hilly country, tiresomely neat. The people who made them didn't really know there were other worlds."
"Quite a big thing not to know," said Random.
"Well, yes," said Arthur.
"So where did they come from?"
"Well, they, that is, we, just sort of grew there. We evolved on the Earth," said Arthur, "from, I don't know, some kind of sludge or something."
"Like this watch," said Random.
"Well, I don't think the watch grew out of sludge," said Arthur. "You don't understand!" Random suddenly leapt to her feet, shouting, "You don't understand! You don't understand me! You don't understand anything! I hate you for being so stupid!" She started to run hectically down the hill, still clutching the watch and shouting that she hated him. Arthur jumped up, startled and at a loss. He started to run down after her through the stringy and clumpy grass. It was hard and painful for him. When he had broken his leg in the crash, it had not been a clean break, and it had not healed cleanly. He was stumbling and wince-faced.
"I don't know what anybody means by anything!"
"What do you mean?"
"Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!"
"Tell me, please tell me," said Arthur. "What do you mean by saying the life she didn't have?"
"She wished she'd stayed on Earth. She wished she hadn't gone off with that stupid brain-dead fruit gum Zaphod. She thinks she would have had a different life."
"But," said Arthur, "she would have been killed. She would have been killed when the world was destroyed."
"Well, that's a different life, isn't it?"
"Well, that's...
She wouldn't have had to have me. She hates me."
You can't mean that. How could anyone possibly, I mean...
"She had me because I was meant to make things fit for her. That was my job. But I fitted even worse than she did. So she just shut me off and carried on with her stupid life."
"What's stupid about her life?" insisted Arthur. "She's fantastically successful, isn't she? She's all over time and space, all over the sub-ether TV networks."
"Stupid! Stupid! Stupid! Stupid!"
Random turned and ran off again. Arthur couldn't keep up with her, and at last he had to sit down for a bit and let the pain in his leg subside. The turmoil in his head, he didn't know what to do with at all. End of